It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
And that is why Taylor Swift never published the song about your breakup.
Well, I guess that's okay, though.
Yeah, I mean, it would have, you know, would have complicated things.
I understand. I just wish she would have told me herself.
And that you sound like most men.
Yeah.
I watched the Just Between Us video, because otherwise I figured we'd have absolutely nothing to talk about. And you are correct in that that is totally a conversation we would have. And for some reason, it's just really easy for me to picture you throwing up your hands in exasperation and saying, I don't want to fuck anybody!
Well, the main thing was...
Except, you are not more fun than sex with strangers, I'm afraid.
Okay, well, the main thing was that we often have these conversations where, you know, you're trying to tell me, you know, it's like she said, there are a lot of sites that sort of bill themselves as a site you use to meet other people,
yes,
not necessarily dating.
Yes.
And you know, there is even a, you know, you're just looking for friends or whatever. And what, that's Allison who was, you know, talking about that, and Gabby was saying, but it just doesn't work that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just not. So
this is a very common conversation.
Yeah, a common conversation.
That's not how the world works. And you're like, why not? Because it would make sense for it to work
well,
that
but
way.
Not,
like,
not,
but it doesn't.
It's not just that it would make sense. It's that on the surface, it looks like it does or should. And you're constantly trying to tell me, well, everybody knows that that's just a facade, or that's just a, that's not real.
The difference is, though, I feel like we don't end up having those conversations until you have been disillusioned. So we wouldn't have the conversation when you were planning to make your friendship profile. We would have it when you made it and you're like, why does everybody want to fuck me?
Well, sure. Or like I go to meet somebody and they clearly take my intentions wrong. And I'm saying to them, but I said right in the profile.
There you go. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I especially like the part where Gabby said that, yes, I do. It is obvious to me that you don't want to sleep with everybody. But yeah, I figured it out after a long time of myself feeling misled by the signals that you were sending that you weren't really sending.
Same thing with me. Up until about 6 months ago, I was pretty sure you wanted to sleep with I did eventually figure it out.
No, but it's like I was watching this thing. I was like, yeah, this is exactly what happens between me and Tony all the time. He's trying to explain to me how people actually take things that I do and say. Well, and I've had this problem my whole life with I'll say and do these things and I'll find out later that it was taken as this by somebody else. And of course, you know, sometimes I'm completely at fault and that's fine. But other times I don't feel like it's all me. I feel like I think that the way I was doing this is perfectly logical and reasonable, but I didn't know that I was operating in a cultural context that interpreted the thing that's this way on the surface. Well, it's kind of like I had a friend who told me that there's kind of a rule between women that you don't date someone if you're friends, you don't date someone that your friend has dated.
Even, I feel like that's a rule amongst people.
Okay, but that's true. Even if you ask the person, hey, I know you dated this guy, but can I date him? And your friend says, oh, sure, I don't mind. You still aren't supposed to do it.
Yeah, that's some bullshit there.
Okay, but there's a lot of things in our
now,
world that work
that
way.
Being said, I would go with, you shouldn't date your friend's ex. Even if they say it is okay, I do believe that. Not because, oh, they're just lying or whatever, but because people don't know. Like, you could totally think you're fine with it, and then it happens, and you're like, oh my God. And so it's just bad.
Right, but there's a lot of things in our culture that are you. I'm not just socially inept. I mean, there are things that people say and do that on the surface look like X, but it's not X. But I take it as X, and then I get in trouble because of that.
Because you were raised on a Methodist farm, and other people were raised by sitcoms. And rules like that are very much from sitcoms. Which is an interesting thing I want to talk about.
Okay, go ahead.
But before that, no, you and Trish... By the way, people, welcome to this. This is... Those of you who know this is essentially the show. So if you're like, what the hell? They didn't even start anything. This is probably not the show for you. I don't mean this episode. I mean this podcast. You and Trish both have this thing that I've noticed a long time, which is, although I feel like Trish might be getting better about it, you not so much. You have, for whatever reason, I mean, it varies, but you have a model, like everyone does, in your head of sort of how things work, how the world works, how society works, how people interacting works. And you guys both get severely rocked when the world doesn't match what your model was.
Well, yes,
but you just get really blown away by the idea, sort of.
But only because, for me, there's a reason. It's not just a matter of, hey, this didn't work the way I wanted. It's because, you know, I have a goal here, and my goal is, you know, to make things better. And I often achieve the exact opposite of what I was going for because...
As like with this podcast.
Yeah, because I thought everybody was on the same page about something, and it turns out that it was the exact opposite, which... Yeah, that always really kind of blows my mind, because how can it be the opposite?
Well, and that's what I don't get, because you and Trish are both very good at... I mean, you're very smart people, and you're very good at reasoning things through and just coming to the absolute wrong conclusion.
The opposite thing.
Yeah, I don't know how you guys do it. It's amazing.
But that's what I'm trying to say, is it's not always... Sometimes it's because what people are saying is the opposite of what they mean. And I'm supposed to know that. I'm supposed to know, okay, you're saying this, but you mean not this. And I almost never pick that up. I almost never understand
that. Well, I feel like it's seldom that cut and dried.
Well,
I feel like it's more often you're like, you say this, and that should rationally mean that, but you want the opposite of that. So clearly you didn't mean this. And in their head, it makes sense to them. They just, I think maybe that's what it is. You and Trish are rational in a way the entire rest of the world is not.
Okay, but no.
You guys came to the accurate conclusions, but we all came to the other conclusion.
But I mean, I'm talking about.
No, because I'm with you on the whole, if somebody says go ahead, then it should be fine.
Yeah,
to go
exactly.
Ahead.
That's what that kind
I,
of thing.
In this instance, I still would say I would advise against it, because even if they are 100% sincere, it could
sure,
be a bad
but
idea.
That's not even
but
the point.
I wouldn't blame you. I would never do that. That to me is some straight up sitcom bullshit. There, if somebody says, "Oh yeah, do that," or the one where people like, let's go through all the lying sitcom tropes here. If people say they don't want a big fuss over their birthday, and they really do, some people think that's a real perfect example. Yeah, no, that's bullshit.
That's a perfect example.
That's not you at all.
Or
that's people
someone
being
says,
stupid.
I just want to be left alone.
And that's not what they actually.
And
want.
That's not what they actually yes. want. Because
no, that's on them. That's absolutely on them.
But
it
never works out to be on them.
No.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I.
But that's. Not your fault. You just need to not hang out with those people. For example, I'm guessing your wife doesn't pull that kind of
no,
stuff.
No. Of course she doesn't.
Exactly.
But
and so that's the trick. The people who do pull that kind of stuff, fuck them.
It's a lot of people. It's a lot of people
I've
known.
I'm down to about 6 people in the world I can tolerate, and I'm fine with that. So,
but see that, yeah, that doesn't work for me. I mean, it doesn't. I'm kind of in the same boat. About 6 people, and that's I don't have a problem with that number, but. There are things I want to accomplish in life that force me to get along with all kinds of people, which I don't even mind. I love getting along with all kinds.
Putting on a production of 12 Angry Men.
Whatever.
So you're going to need more than 7.
Exactly. And I like interacting with people, and I get along with all kinds of people, but they don't get along with me because it comes down to I treat people the way I want to be treated. And you know, the way I want to be treated is when I say something, I want you to take me at my word. Yeah. Because even if later I realize I didn't really mean it, like if I say, look, I just want to be left alone and everybody does that and I'm by myself and I'm thinking, you don't really want to be left alone. That's on me.
Yeah.
I think to myself, you jerk, you know, you shouldn't have said what you didn't mean. I don't blame them for taking me at my word. That's what I want them to do because I'd rather them err on the side of trusting I know what I'm talking about, right? Than second guessing everything I'm going to say.
And I'm not going to counter that. I am first and foremost a proponent of honest communication.
Right.
Always have been.
And
to me, I'm like, the solution to that is to maybe teach those people to be honest in their communication, or easier, more accurate, just cut them out of your life.
Well, but another aspect of it is, I also get that just like I don't always, you know, I try to say what I mean and mean what I say, but of course I'm not always going to do that. And other people are the same way, and I want to be sensitive to that. Sometimes I want to be sensitive enough to know this person is saying they want to be alone, but I have a feeling they don't really want to. And so that's fine too.
And that's a whole component. It is useful to learn why people say things they don't mean.
But
and I do feel like you have no clue why people say things they don't mean.
Well, but I'm saying sometimes I do. Like, sometimes I get it, and I know if it's appropriate to actually leave them alone or not. I'm talking about this whole other level where there's, like, social rules. Like,
yeah, those are not real. I mean, social rules are real, but the ones you're talking about, pretty much a lie.
Except a lot of people live by them.
And we call those people dumbasses.
But that turns out to be a lot of people.
A lot of people are dumbasses.
Like, I find that very discouraging.
As you should, for the way you want to live your life. Like...
But you know, what I've discovered, though...
Humanity is just the worst.
No, that's not true. What I've discovered is that across the board, most of the time, where I feel like I'm running into a problem and it's not all me or even mostly me...
Is when dealing with Asians?
No.
I assume that's what you're going to say?
Is...
You're pretty racist.
What all of these encounters and problems and difficulties have in common is... At the moment the difficulty starts, the person I'm having a difficulty with, and like I say, two people, I mean, I'm contributing to it too, but where I feel like it's not really mostly me, and it's really mostly this person, they're behaving in a manner that I would describe as not entirely adult.
Oh, yeah.
Like, if they were actually a 13-year-old, we wouldn't be having a problem, because I'd be thinking to myself, oh, this is a 13-year-old. And I'd be able to communicate with them, interact with them. But they're not a 13-year-old. They're a 40-year-old. And I've also...
There are plenty of 40-year-olds who act like 13-year-olds.
And since I've noticed this, I've also realized that if I go ahead and treat them like they're a 13-year-old, sometimes that resolves the problem. But I hate doing that because I wouldn't want someone to do that to me. Because I'm sure I'm prone to act like a 13-year-old sometimes. What do I want people to do when I'm like that? To say, hey, stop acting like a 13-year-old.
Yeah, no, that's the worst thing.
That's what I want them to do.
Because people are not frequently willing to admit weakness or fault.
Right. So I don't want.
First of all, they don't know they're doing it. But second of all, if you presented them with it, it would just embarrass them.
Probably,
so
or make them angry.
The trick is to treat them like a 13-year-old without being overt about it.
But I don't want to do that.
Yeah, no,
it makes me feel icky to do it. So I don't want to do it. So
your only other recourse is to either basically versions of lying. You can take it upon yourself. Yeah, sorry, that was me for not knowing, which it totally was not. Or you can be upfront and honest, and then they're not going to want to hang out with you.
Okay, but here's another thing.
He called me a 13-year-old. Well, you were a 13-year-old, but I don't want him to call me that.
I'm realizing that this is a general problem in our culture, that people get stuck at a certain age, and it's not that they occasionally act like 13-year-olds. It's like they're always acting this way.
You can tell.
That this is a big problem in our culture, And another problem is that they're rewarded for it. Like, some of the most immature people I've ever known were CEOs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Right.
I've known a couple, and they acted like morons all the time.
It becomes a little chicken and egg sometimes. Sometimes I think they're put in situations where they don't have to grow, and therefore they never do. But if you're in a position of power, then it becomes a constant thing. Yeah, no, Humanity's the worst, dude. I'm
No, it's not true. Our
but
culture...
it is why I start to think in terms less about age and in terms of, like, life milestones. Like, I always talk about Trish and I are 5 years apart, but pretty much where we were in our lives was exactly the same point when we got together. And lucky thing it was. Had either of us been slightly off, I don't think we would have made a successful couple.
Yeah, and I think that's
generally true of
anybody. And if you
look back at the ways we behaved and the decisions we were making and the plans we were making just prior to us getting together, they match up pretty well, even though, like I said, there's a five-year difference.
Well, I think our culture in general has... We've got a lot of... There are many things in our culture and absent from our culture that sort of discourages people in it from growing up. You know, for one thing, we've got this culturally constructed thing called adolescence that's far too long. I mean, it goes from like 8 to 30. We culturally glorify that period of time. We tell people who are past that period that they have to look and act like they're still in that period of time. I mean, we don't really have a rite of passage in our culture. I mean, that's a huge problem. So I don't know what it means for our culture in the long term, because you can't. that seems almost to be inescapable, because you can't have a bunch of middle school people running this country or being in charge of our culture and expect that it's going to continue on in a positive or progressive way.
Goddamn humans.
It's not humans. It's a particular culture. I mean, humans aren't all this way. They haven't
been
this...
No, they're all terrible and unique in different ways in different cultures.
You don't really think that about humanity, do you? You're not really that down.
I wouldn't go that far, but I'm getting there. I am getting increasingly misanthropic.
So when you were studying,
I'm really getting into the school of thought that people suck. Certain persons are cool, but people in aggregate always suck.
When you were studying cultural anthropology, did you have a particular? I mean, did you feel that way then? Like, well, you know,
no. I was all full of hope and shit back then.
Really.
Well, I mean, I was young. I was not.
That's very hard to imagine.
I was not disillusioned yet.
That's very.
I wasn't
hard
exactly
to imagine.
Chipper, but
chipper.
I still had like dreams and plans and that kind of shit.
I guess.
No, my real cynicism has been the last decade easily.
Well, I don't.
In fact, since I knew you.
Well, I wouldn't call myself disillusioned or cynical. I mean, I'm constantly learning.
No, I'm pretty sure that me looking at you has made me disillusioned with humanity, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
You soured me on the species. Way to go.
Well, that's perfectly understandable.
Good job, Dairy Queen.
Because if anything could sour me on the species, it's me.
Okay, Dairy Queen.
Okay, knock it off.
I made a mistake. Do you think of me as a one-legged puppy? No, I think of you as a two-legged elephant.
Should we tell people what this show is?
Hello.
Even told them what episode it is.
Hello,
I don't know if
everyone.
I can remember that.
Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat Podcast, the only podcast that starts 20 minutes in.
Very frequently, that's the case.
I'm Tony.
And I'm William. And this is episode 277, I think.
I think you're right.
Off the top of my head, trying to remember.
Addy is double the size of when we got him. He went from a pound and a half to 3 pounds.
Doesn't look much bigger.
If you see him more often, you can tell. He's getting to the point where it's hard to just pick him up with one hand. You can do it, but it's tricky now. Everybody's still annoyed by him, because he's still just a little kid. He just always wants to play. But they're not often... But he has times, well, you can kind of see it now, where he is neither asleep nor playing, where he's just, like, hanging out.
Well, here's the thing about him that I find really interesting, the last several times I've been here. This isn't a huge house, but it's not a small house. I mean, there's lots of other places he could be.
Yeah.
But he's right here.
No, he's very social.
Likes to be where the people are.
Or the cats. He likes to be where the
But that's what I'm saying is Ezzy wasn't even in this room a second ago. Twiglet's not, so he could be bothering either one of them.
Well, I think he has a tendency to go for humans because historically, meaning in the few weeks he's been alive, humans play with him. Cats don't so much. He tries to get them to play, but will actually play with him.
I see.
For those of you just joining us, here's how this works. We have a hat. It's magical in that it has its own email address. themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. And people like yourselves, not nearly enough of them, write in to that email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with little notes, comments, questions, things like that.
Yeah,
topics.
Things like
stuff,
that.
Stuff. Little things. The hat, all on its own, magically, transmogrifies those emails into little note cards with the information written on them that manifests physically within the hat itself. We, it's Etruscan servants.
Etruscan? Nice.
Draw those note cards out of the hat at random, read them on the air, talk about them until we're bored, do that for about an hour, that's the whole show.
Although I'm sure that's hard to believe.
Because we don't usually do that.
Because, yeah, like Garky said, we've been talking for a long time. Without even talking about what the show's about.
So, that reminds me. So, I'm talking with Stu the other... Well, actually, this goes back further than that. Earlier, maybe a couple weeks ago, Saturday night, PBS shows British sitcoms.
Okay.
This is a common thing. Even in Oregon, there was a certain night of the week that was like British sitcom night. I don't know what it was about, but they do that. That's PBS shows British sitcoms. It's just a thing. But it's a thing in Iowa, too. And I like watching them. And the two that I particularly like that are on right now are one called, a famous one that most people, if they know any British comedy, know, Are You Being Served?
Mm-hmm.
Big one from the 70s and 80s.
Yep,
and another one that is arguably the longest running sitcom in history, we just recently found out, called The Last of the Summer Wine, which takes place in a small village in, I think, Yorkshire, and went from, like, the 70s till the early 2000s, like it really was a long time. Yeah. And I like both of these. Now, I mostly like shows like this because I'm a big Anglophile and they're very Britishy, and I like the Britishism of it. But I'm watching the other night, and I'm like, these shows are dumb. Like, I mean, I'm still enjoying myself, but I'm like, why were these popular? Because it's like the same three or four pretty cheap gags every episode, just repeated ad nauseum, every episode. Why? Like, you know, Are You Being Served is a great one. Like, I could just tally off all the jokes, and they will show up in every episode, frequently multiple times. You know, John Inman might be gay, we don't know. Mrs. Slocum is very old and misuses the word unanimous and overuses the word pussy in an inappropriate context. Captain Peacock is obsessed with his class distinctions. Mr. Rumbold is an idiot and hears bad and he has large ears and people make fun of him for it. Like, it's just the same shit every single time. And a lot of slapstick. I'm like, but these were popular. Why is that?
For a very long time.
Yeah. And Last of Summer Wine, it's a similar kind of thing. Oh, people are old. Oh, women and men are different. You know, people out in the country are kind of crazy. You know, it's the usual shit. And I'm like, how do they never notice? And then it hit me. We did the same thing in America. If you go back, especially if you look around the 80s at our sitcoms.
Regular sitcoms?
Yeah.
Sure.
Don't say regular. It sounds racist. With American sitcoms. As opposed to British ones. You call the American ones the regular sitcoms.
Well, I didn't mean in contrast to British. I meant...
You've always hated the Brits. We know.
I meant standard...
yes. American sitcoms do the same thing. If you go back and think to, you know, Growing Pains. Now, we were a little bit more fixated on the very special episode. And that would mess things up. But in general, that's how it was. Forever and ever and ever.
Yeah.
And I didn't notice at the time. Looking back, I can see that. But I didn't notice at the time. And I probably only notice in the British ones because it's a different culture or context, so it stands out. So, anyway, this is my theory. I tell it to Trish. I think it's kind of interesting. I mention it to Stu at work, who, as we all know, is from Wales. And he says,
yeah.
But then once he remembers that I don't speak Welsh, he says, you know, this could be a thing. You're right. And he says, it would explain something that happened the other day. And I said, what? And he said, we watched this show, something with Michael J. Fox wearing a dress shirt and tie. And my wife, who I also found it hilarious, and I didn't really get it. And I was like, I feel like that's the concluding paragraph to my thesis right there. I'm like, that's exactly what I'm talking about in reverse cultural context. Because family ties, hilarious. But you know what? I'll bet it suffers from the exact same things. But I didn't notice because it was my culture. And for him, it just is weird and not that funny because it wasn't his cultural context.
Although family ties is very American. I mean, when I think of things about family ties that I thought was clever or funny, it's all about American politics.
It's a lot about American politics.
I mean, things that if you didn't grow up here, there's no reason you'd even understand it.
Well, and the British things, too, like, there's a Britcom called Yes Minister, and I don't understand why anybody likes it. I love the show. A lot of Brits I know love the show. But the only reason I love the show is it's so insanely British. It's just a sitcom about the government. Like it's like a toned down, non-dramatic, not very low stakes West Wing. It's just with one guy who becomes a cabinet minister sort of accidentally, sort of there was no other option, and him working that job, and he has a staff that's, you know, dedicated civil servants, so they've been around before him, they'll be there after him, and all of their sort of corrupt, how they get things done behind the scenes. But it's all just the most British monologues and jokes ever. Like, I believe Trish watched half an episode with me one time, and she's like, I honestly don't even know what they're talking about. And it wasn't like she couldn't understand the accent. She's like, I full-on can't follow most of these sentences.
Well, it seems to me that a lot of Monty Python's humor was just making fun of British names for things.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, just Britishness.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think.
And I'm sure there's tons of American ones. Now, in my experience, really, in a lot of countries, they get a lot more American TV than we get their TV. So they probably have a little more cultural saturation.
But I don't think American TV generally makes fun of Americanisms. I mean, they have tropes, they have formulas like you're talking about. I mean, when you look at an American sitcom, you will notice if you pay attention that they just do the same gags over and over and over again. But I'm talking about a little something different here where a lot of British humor makes fun of Britain and Britishness. I'm not sure I know very many sitcoms that make fun of American.
Well, you said Monty Python, yes. And that's a sketch thing. And if we go to American sketch, they absolutely do that.
Yeah,
all
true.
Over the place.
That's true.
The other thing would just be there. Potentially we don't notice as again because we're steeped in it. So it's not. It's possible that a lot of the stuff you're talking about may not have been nearly as overt to the British.
Yeah, I suppose going back to family ties, and I was saying that there are a lot of things that are very American there that you wouldn't know if you weren't raised here. In a way, I guess you could say they were making fun of Republicans and Democrats
both.
And some of the things they argue about.
They made fun of hippies. They made fun
of yuppies. Yeah.
They made fun of the American dream.
That's right. That's true. I didn't really think, like you said, though, I didn't really think about it like that.
Well, because you have a very nuanced view of it. You're like, I live here. I understand there's funny things about it. Mm-hmm. That's just called conversation.
Yeah.
And you'd see that, well, and of course, in the 90s, I found out not just in this country, but in other countries, there was a rash of sketch comedies where the basic theme of the show was, here's a minority group that lives in this country, we're going to do sketches all about them, meaning all about their concerns, but also a lot about their stereotypes, their tropes, things like that. In Living Color was a great example here, House of Buggin' was a great example here, and the one I talk about all the time in Britain was called Goodness Gracious Me, that was all about Indian and near Asian immigrants to there, and they have things like there was a reoccurring set that were these two Indian couples that lived in Britain that were so keen to assimilate. Like, they changed their names, and they made all these very British claims, not even necessarily understand. That would be the joke. They'd talk about, like, how big they're into golf. And as it went on, you'd find out they didn't really understand golf, but they kept trying to one-up each other with how British they were. And that's the thing. So a lot of that came out of the 90s, which was very directly poking fun at that kind of stuff.
The Simpsons pokes fun at American.
Oh my god! Fucking came up again recently. Watching an episode of At Midnight, and somebody made a joke that the punchline was basically that the Simpsons hasn't been good for a very long time, and the audience went boo, and Chris Hardwick is like, "Are you guys currently watching The Simpsons?" And they're like, "No," and I was like, "Then shut the fuck up!" And I'm like, "Fuck you! I do currently watch The Simpsons, and it's awesome. In a lot of ways, it's better than it was in a lot of the early days. Like, it has become like 30 Rock. It is incredibly tight. The jokes per minute are amazing. It's incredibly insightful. It has these incredibly layered and nuanced jokes in a lot of cases. Like, it's tight. Everybody who's like Simpsons isn't good anymore saw like 5 minutes once, and they weren't really paying attention. Like, no, Simpsons is still awesome. Now, I'm not saying I would protest if it got canceled, because no show really needs to be around for 28 goddamn years, but it's still worth watching. Got something on this thing. My ankle's getting all swollen on this side. I don't know what's going on with that. So how was your week?
Oh, well, you know, my dad got married on
the
25th. That was...
And you were not there for that?
No.
But...
That was the... I think I mentioned that was... That's his parents' wedding anniversary. Yeah. So that's why he kind of chose that date. Well, actually, apparently there was a lot of discussion about when it would happen. And he gave the bride a several dates that she could choose from. And most of them were like late this year, early next. And she said, well, I don't want to wait that long. So it really only left... like this weekend in June, yeah. And Dad thought, well, hey, you know what? That's my parents' wedding anniversary. Let's get married then. Okay, fine. So then they had the reception the next day, as I told everybody they would do. And I had to sing a couple numbers in it, I think I said. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of
nervous. I assume you did Mambo number 5.
I was really nervous about it. What I did was, and I think I said I would do, I Can't Help Falling in Love With You, but it was specifically Elvis Presley.
Yeah, not the UB40 version.
Yeah, 1961. Now, here's the thing.
I'm still disappointed about that.
Here's the thing. I am not... I've performed in a lot of places. I was sort of known as a vocalist in the area. People would call me up to have me do weddings and stuff like that. So I've been that person.
This is true.
No, it is true. And I've been that guy, you know, who's... You know, if you go to, like, you know, Melcher Dallas has, like, a lot of small towns all over the country, but especially Iowa, has summer
people.
Like these summer festival type things. Theirs is called Coal Miners Day because there are a lot of coal miners in Melcher, especially. And you know,
Dallas is much more about the natural gas.
Someone would want to put on a show for Coal Miners Day, and they'd get all of
What am I saying? Dallas is all about the oil.
Anyway,
how did I forget that? I feel like a dumbass.
You know, like people putting together...
Did Melcher Dallas ever figured out who shot JR?
People putting together Coal Miners Day might want to put on a show, and they'd have all the people who are music performers in town come and perform in it, and I would be one of those people they would call. So, and I was in plays, and I did improvisational acting and all this stuff. But I was never one of those people that enjoyed performing. You know, you hear about these people, especially now when people watch America's Got Talent or American Idol or whatever, you'll hear people say, oh, I love to be on stage. I love to hear the applause. I love to sing. I love to do this. Yeah. I was never that person.
Then why did you perform?
Well, it was mostly because I just didn't know how to say no.
Mm.
You know, I didn't know how to say no to people, especially my dad. I didn't know how to say no to. But I never, ever really enjoyed it, ever. I was usually petrified before going on stage.
I understand being scared. I've had that lots of times. But
well, the reason I was scared, though. I wasn't scared because I was performing. I was scared because I knew I didn't want to do it, which meant that my heart wasn't going to be in it, which meant that it probably wasn't going to be very good. And I was going to get up and all in front of these people, and I was going to disappoint. It was more of a... I'm going to disappoint all of these people, so I should have just said no. See what I'm saying? It's complicated, I know, but I didn't like doing it. I was okay at it, obviously, or else people wouldn't have been asking me to do it, but I just didn't enjoy it. Now, there were a lot of things I did enjoy in terms of getting up in front of people and public speaking and things like that, like this podcast, for example. I never...
Wait, you enjoy this podcast?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I never dread coming here. And it's not that... I mean, I've often talked about things about it that are very uncomfortable for me and unpleasant for me, but those things are way outweighed by all the things I like about it, including visiting with you, whatever. So I never feel any dread about coming here and doing this. And most of the time, I really look forward to it. And there are other types of performance-oriented things like that that I like, public speaking-oriented stuff, even things that I don't have any script, anything written down for. In fact, usually I especially like those because then I don't feel any pressure. Just go off the cuff and it's fine. But
sorry, you reminded me when I gave my presentation for my lean processing project. They called me up to do it, and I went up there. I'm like, this is so exciting. I wonder what I'm going to say.
Yeah, you said that last time.
Oh, did I? It was fun.
But if I have if I'm performing a song or if I'm acting in a script or whatever, well, then there's pressure to, you know, you've got to do it right. Mm. You can't forget the words, you know, whatever. And that, I don't enjoy that. So
you're saying you hated your dad's wedding?
I'm saying that when Dad asked me to do this, I immediately felt a lot of stress about it. I was back in that place where, well, really not just for my sake, but for his sake, I should say no, right? Because I don't, you know, he's not going to want me to screw it up. And he probably doesn't, if he really knew how it made me feel to do it, he probably wouldn't want me to do it. On the other hand, this is a big day for him, and I'm sure he really wants this to happen.
And he would feel way worse if you refused than if you screwed it up.
It seems like it because...
No, that's always the case.
Here's another aspect of it is that the woman he married is a musician, and she plays organ and piano at churches and stuff, and she teaches piano, and she's got a very musical family, and they were going to be there performing stuff, right? So and I'm the only one on his side of things who would even have begun to approach doing that,
because the rest of the family's all plate spinners.
Well, they just don't do that stuff. So I was all he had, basically, in terms of, you know, him contributing something to the program. So I agreed to do it. But it was very stressful for the, like, 3 or 4 weeks up to it that I was thinking about doing it. So I get there, and I get there really early because they asked us to for sound check reasons, and I was there even earlier still. But the sound guy was there, so I could do a sound check really when nobody else was there. And so I performed. I had a backup recording that my music partner Chris made for me, and I did the song, and it seemed like it went really well in the sound check. So I thought, okay, well, maybe this will be all right. But for some reason, when it was actually time to do it, I was more nervous than I've ever been up in front of a crowd singing something, and I don't know why. I mean, it was like beyond anything I've ever experienced before, because usually what used to happen was I'd like feel totally sick to my stomach, and like I wish something would happen so I didn't have to do this, like someone would pull a fire alarm or something. But once I got up there, I was fine. Not so this time. I mean, my knee was shaking and everything. I was so nervous. It's like, how am I going to nail this performance when, you know, my voice is probably going to shake? How am I going to hit the right notes? And that just made me more nervous, and there was this kind of negative feedback.
That's my big, scary one, and I don't know what causes it, because things that would seem bigger deals than other things don't bother me, but then times, yeah, that's the same thing as I tremble a lot, and I get really hot.
Well, and
my voice shakes.
I was up in front of the crowd before. They wanted me to introduce Dad's family, which I wasn't prepared to do that. It was a last-minute thing I was asked to do. Did it make me nervous? No. Was I scared or anything? No. I got up in front of people. I cracked a few jokes. It was fine. And I even was grateful for that opportunity because I thought, well, this will break the ice a little bit and calm me down. But it didn't do that. So I don't know what was going on that day, but for whatever reason,
let me ask you, I was totally freaked out. Let me ask you this. You are aware that the quality of your performance was probably the least significant aspect of the whole thing.
Yeah.
All right. I just want, so you're aware that this is a wholly irrational fear.
Oh, because yeah.
Literally nobody cares if you do a good job at it.
Pretty much.
Okay.
I mean,
I just wanted to make sure.
But for whatever reason,
it happens. That's how.
But it's never happened to me. I mean, like I said, I've been nervous and this stuff about things. But usually when it starts, I'm fine. But this is the first
time.
Maybe
it's because you haven't done it in a while.
Well, it is true. I haven't done it for a very, very long time.
Or maybe because you had a lot of strong feelings about this event, it just pushed everything even.
You know,
harder.
That's a good point. I didn't even think about that. Because, I mean,
if somebody hired you to perform at someone's wedding, not as big a deal. Your dad's like, you, my son, sing for us at my wedding.
Yeah.
That's a big, sounds like a big thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right about that. Well, you know, and this year marks 10 years since my mom passed away. And, which...
10 years already, wow.
And, I mean, I'm very glad that he's met someone. And see, that's another thing is, I'm very happy about this, and I think it's going to be really good for Dad. I think he's been pretty sad and depressed for the last 10 years. So I want it to work out.
And it's always, that's always the thing with a new spouse. Either someone is sort of resentful that they're trying to replace their parent, in which case it's awkward, or someone is not feeling that way, but knows that that would be a concern, and so it's awkward because they're working really hard to prove
how much
they don't feel like that.
Well, and it for me, there's a, and I'm kind of realizing this just as we're talking about it. For me, there's a lot at stake because, you know, Dad's past 70 now, and you know
this is probably the last wedding.
He talks about, you know, the end of his life and stuff, which I don't want to happen anytime soon, you know. It would, you know, if anything happened to my dad, God forbid, in a year or so, it would be way too soon for me. So I think there's part of my brain that's thinking, you know, this might be something that helps my dad live a little bit longer than he would have otherwise. So I feel like I've got a lot invested in it being good and working out. And then I might have taken all of that emotional energy and put it on the irrationally, as you said, put it on the quality of this performance. Irrational and stupid, but probably something going on in the back of my brain that way.
And weirdly, this is one of the least weird things you do.
What's that?
I'm saying the story you just told me is something a regular person might tell me, and we would not be surprised. I'm saying this is extremely emblematic of the human condition, especially in this culture.
Oh, no, I think you're right about that. So anyway,
congratulations.
But anyhow, here I am, just so scared. I've never been so scared in my life, it doesn't seem like. And I have to sing this song.
And you start hearing the reggae backbeat.
No. So,
he loves bags.
It's a good thing that I practiced it earlier, because I had what I felt like was a good baseline to kind of judge it against, just, you know, in terms of how I'd feel about it. And somehow I got through it, and it wasn't a total disaster. I mean, I don't think I was ever off. I don't think, you know, like I didn't hit a note or something. But I knew it wasn't quite, I don't know, as soulful or expressive or whatever as my practice version had been. So I was kind of disappointed when I got off the stage. But, you know, my wife had heard my earlier performance, and she barely noticed that there was even a difference. I mean, when I talked to her about it, she said, okay, yeah, I guess there was a little difference, and I did prefer the practice version, but until you said something...
Well, it's always worth it as a performer. You spent years doing theater, and you know something screws up, there's a 90% chance the audience didn't notice.
Exactly.
Even if it's something huge.
Well, or
afterwards, you're like, how did you guys not notice that, like, he dropped that thing or whatever? And they're like, oh, I just thought it was part of the show.
So she assured me that it was not significantly like worse than my other performance, and so I could feel a little bit good about it. And then there, I got some feedback from some other people, and it was nice. So I think it went okay.
I would imagine.
But it felt weird all day afterwards. Like, why was I so scared? Why? And I felt bad that it wasn't absolutely as good as it could be, because I thought the practice went so well.
Is that you're right? Do you have to go?
Why do you always do that?
Because I have no other joke other than like, dude, maybe someone's house is burning down. See, it's not as funny.
But for like 2 days afterwards, I felt weird. Mm-hmm. I feel fine now, but I felt a little off about it for a couple days. But the whole event went fine. And
that's why most people drink at weddings.
Since...
No, seriously, I've talked about this. I because I'm not very good at knowing when to say when, drank way too much wine at my friend's wedding, in which I was one of the best men involved. There were two best men. I was one of them. So I had to give a speech. I had not written a speech down. I had thought about it over, like, the last 2 days
a little bit. Sure.
But that was it. And I was, I'm not even going to say tipsy, I was pretty much drunk up there. I took my wine glass up with me to the microphone. Afterward, a woman I had never met and have never seen since came up to me, eyes a little misty, and told me that was a beautiful, heartfelt toast. I'm telling you, stuff's magic.
Okay.
Also, it kills your brain cells, but it's magic. That could be magic, too. It might do it magically. I don't know.
Well, anyway, that's my story about it. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if any of our listeners are performers.
Well, sing it now. We'll see how you sound.
That's right. The most of the rest of the week was just working on episode 2 of my little the thing that I wrote that I let you read the first episode of. And we continue to watch Scandal and usually be appalled by it, but there's just a lot of good things in it. I mean, it's, I don't know. One person's performance that almost always impresses me is the woman who's playing the first lady. It's really good. And it's really fun to watch her. But and there's often really good stuff in it, but then they'll turn around and do this really terrible stuff. So I just don't know.
Well, I have that with things sometimes. Dresden Files is like that. 90% of it I love. 10% of it I really fucking hate.
But yeah, it's like there's nothing in between.
I still say it's some of my favorite books. I think it's just easier to notice when there's that extreme. So we only got like 15 minutes left, so let me run through a couple quick things here.
Okay.
I have just passed the 32,000 word mark on my book.
Oh.
And I know the rest of the book. Like, at least as far as an outline in my head, I know what the rest of the story is. Which, that's only been true for like 3 days, but I do know what the rest of the story is. So that's good. I am playing Minecraft. I went and got Minecraft. Have you guys done Minecraft?
No.
You should do Minecraft.
Why?
Because your wife would love it.
She probably would.
She would love it. And there's console versions of it.
Well, I don't know, though. I mean, and I could have predicted what was going to happen with Fallout if I'd known what it was like, but just based on what Fallout's been.
You're not sure your guys' life can handle it?
Yeah.
Like that. Well, there
we
is
might,
that.
We might disappear from
existence.
I feel
like I'm going to be obsessed with this, which I am right now, for like 2 or 3 weeks. Because in the past, I played a game called Terraria, which is basically a 2D version of this. And I was completely obsessed for a couple weeks and then never have touched it again. So I'm guessing that's what's going to happen here. But so I'm playing that. I'm having fun with that. Saw one movie. Well, actually, I saw a couple, but they were dumb ones. Saw a movie called Stage Fright that really sucked. It's an 80s movie about a murder in a theater while a dance troupe is trying to rehearse their show that happens in 3 days. And it had very little dancing in it. I'm like, what the hell? That was why I would watch this. 80s dancing is awesome. But no, it was very little. And the slasher twist was one of the dumbest I've ever run into. It's basically the police forgot to check for bodies, and 2 days later, turns out the murderer is still alive. But now he's dead. Like, it was a really dumb twist, so don't worry about that. But, last night, the producer had us watch The Vavitch.
That sounds familiar.
It just came out recently. It's called The Witch. But for some reason, the way they do the lettering, it's 2 V's, so I always call it The Vavitch. But it came out not long ago.
Yeah, we saw it.
Oh, did you see it?
Yeah.
Well, how did you feel about it?
My wife felt like it was an interesting kind of attempt to make a horror story or horror thriller the way, 17th century English settlers would write it.
I guess I could see that.
Like, you know, what would, you know, if you could take those people and bring them here and say, and kind of teach them how to make a horror movie,
yeah.
What would they make?
Well, and supposedly it is largely based on found journals and shit.
Right, and so Puritans. And so that aspect of it fascinated her. And when she said that, I thought, yeah, I guess that was kind of interesting about it. I also do think that she found it effective as a story told in that genre, but I don't think overall we were, like, you know, blown away by it or anything, like we buy it or watch it again.
Yeah, we really didn't like it. Yeah. And at first I thought it would just be me because I had not anticipated ever seeing it. So I read up a ton on it. So I basically knew the plot and everything. What's fascinating is I knew the plot. I had read the movie spoiler thing, which is a play-by-play that people do of, and even then, like, I knew everything was going to happen, and none of it happened the way I thought it was going to. I thought it was much more trying to walk a line between supernatural thriller and psycho thriller, and in reality it was sort of neither of those, and it was just really bleak and sort of depressing more than scary. It wasn't very scary at all.
No.
And this is possibly just the way my mind is working lately. For me, it was a scathing critique of fundamentalist Christianity, which I don't think was the intention at all.
No,
but constantly
not.
Through it, I'm just like, it's because of you guys and your fucking beliefs that make no sense. Like, all and just everybody, yeah, it sucked. But it sucked. That being said, it was gorgeously shot. It was shot in a wonderful location. It was impeccably performed, in my opinion. It had pretty decent effects. It was just a depressing story that I did not give a damn about.
It really had a sense of authenticity to it, other than its overclaimed authenticity. It really felt authentic.
What weirded me out is we start the movie, and the guy's talking, the dad is talking, but you don't see him yet. But I know that voice.
Yeah.
And he was the obnoxious traveling salesman in the British version
office,
of The Office, which could not have been a different part from this. So for a little while, it was very weird. But luckily, he looked very different. Because in that, he has a little tiny mustache, and he's sort of balding and stuff. And this, he had big hair and full beard and all that stuff. But I was like, oh my God, that's him. But to his credit, 10 minutes in, stop thinking about that.
I
feel bad for everybody involved, because like I said, I feel it was really well crafted. It just was a story I didn't give a fuck about.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that I felt the same way in terms of the story. I mean, it wasn't creepy, scary. It wasn't much of a thriller. It wasn't much of a horror movie.
And it was way less. I honestly thought it was going to be one of those that sort of left you sort of guessing, did things happen, did things not happen, that kind of thing. No. It is not. I think it very much has a perspective as to what went down.
Yep.
So that was disappointing, too, because to me, that's an interesting thing you can do, if you can do it well in a movie, is you finish it later and you're like, well, it was either a story about XYZ, or it was a story about... And this one, they very clearly
had this there. This story was about one thing. There's no plot twists,
For a little while, I thought we could do some unreliable narrator stuff, but then that threw out. Because for a long time, like, the weirdest parts either had one witness or no witnesses. But then, much later on, there were plenty of people, and I'm like, no, okay, whatever.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. So, I mean, I suppose there's one thing that's revealed that is supposed to surprise you, but it won't if you're paying attention.
No,
it's just a very straightforward... It's like a ghost story with... But except not a particularly good one, where there's a twist. It's just a straight up, this haunting happened. You know,
my
it's not that interesting.
My absolute favorite thing about it was a 3-second shot that involved, very near the end of the movie, someone walking across the screen, and we only see their feet.
Okay.
I don't want to. I feel like I could get into spoilery territory. I felt like you might get from that. And things change as their feet move across.
Okay, sure.
You know what I'm talking about?
I think I do.
I loved that shot. Immediately following it was a shot that I thought was really dumb and not a good follow-up to it. But that shot actually made me go, whoa, that was kind of cool. They did it really kind of neat. And that was my favorite thing, and that's really sad. So yeah, don't recommend the Vavitch. I think there's a quick do a question before the hat explodes or whatever happens.
Whatever happens.
Gonna be something really involved.
Coffee.
Coffee. What a shock.
Fills the whole card.
I love when coffee writes us. She's keeping us in business.
But usually we
can
go for hours.
Also need to write us. Do it. Now.
You're having lunch with three people whom you respect and value.
That seems unlikely.
They start criticizing one of your close friends without knowing that they are close to you. Their criticism is unjust and offensive. What would you do?
This is interesting to me because Coffee is a close friend of mine and frequently has lunch with other people at work. So this could totally be a story about people shitting on me. For me, this is very straightforward. I don't know if it is for you.
It kind of is because, I mean, I've had this experience, although...
What I have more often is I'm having lunch with people, and people start criticizing somebody I'm close to. But it's legitimate criticism. And they're pretty harsh about it. But it's stuff that I can't tell them they're not true.
Yeah, that's not happened.
True. And that, I'm much more congenial and nice about it. I'll be like, yeah, they are kind of like that sometimes. But really, they're not so bad. They're friends of mine. If it's stuff that I feel is genuinely unjust and untrue, I will totally call them out. Absolutely. I'll try not to be a dick about it, but I'll be like, actually, they're nothing like that.
Unjust and offensive. I mean, that part, I don't know if I've experienced that in particular. But what I've experienced is something like this, where they know that I'm close to this person, but they talk like this about them anyway. But being completely unjust and offensive, and maybe I'm just really easy to, not very easy to offend. I mean, because, you know, when people say outrageous things, I often just don't take them very seriously. I feel like they're just blowing off steam, so I'm really hard to offend when it comes to things like this. So I really have to kind of, it is kind of straightforward, but I have to sort of think, all right, so this person actually offends me by what they're saying.
Well, and that gets weird, too, because I believe that offensiveness is a personal thing. But say, for example, the friend in question is of color and what they're saying is racist.
Okay.
Then it's a whole other thing. And then I don't even necessarily bring the friend into it. I'm like, hey, fuckers, that's racist. Knock that shit off.
That's true.
The unjust version is if, like, I'm having lunch with people and they start complaining that you are so rude and boorish. Like, if they were complaining that you talk about a TV show, like, for 8 years, just saying the same thing over again, I'm like, yeah, but it's insightful stuff the first time. You have to deal with it. But if they're like, he's just so rude and he always interrupts and he's such a jerk to everybody, I'd be like, you must be talking about a different William Wright.
Right, but you wouldn't be
what the hell?
You wouldn't be offended, though.
No, but if they're like, that honky cracker. Like, no, that's the only thing. In general... Well, I don't know. If somebody was gainsaying something about somebody I cared about, that, like, not only is that not true about them, but the opposite is true, and that's something I admire about them. Like, somebody who I know to be really generous and self-sacrificing, and they're like, that person is so selfish. I'm not going to let it slide. If I actually consider somebody being unjust in their criticism, if it's somebody that I feel like it's going to... If it's somebody that I'm like, yeah, you just met them and you'll probably never talk to them again. Whatever. But for the most part, no, I'm going to call them out.
Yeah, I think most of the time I would say... Although I'm sure I would still somehow be diplomatic about it.
Well, yeah, you can go, really? I've never found that to be the case. Like, people put that...
You said, that if it's sexist or racist, then that's what I'm going to address. I'm not going to so much address them talking about my friend that way.
And it gets tricky because it depends on the friends.
Yeah.
There are some friends where I'm going to say, I've really never found that to be true. There are some friends where I'm going to say, maybe we shouldn't talk about this because I actually like that person a lot. And there's other friends where I'm going to be like, you're full of crap. And those are not interchangeable options by any means.
No,
so
I agree with that, too.
The friends, but I mean, and I think the major question is, I'm never going to be, like, just quiet about it or, like, pretend to agree.
Well, another important part of the question is, they're people whom you respect and value. Like,
If
I was sitting...
Not just fucking strangers.
Yeah, if I was sitting at a table with, like, back when we worked where we worked, if it was the CEO and the CEO was bad-mouthing a coworker of ours, I probably wouldn't waste my time.
Funny you should mention that. It has me remembering a very specific instance.
Yes, I do recall that.
Yep.
I probably wouldn't waste
especially my time. Offensive because the fucker in question was dead.
That said, if I felt like that conversation was reflecting poorly on this person professionally or something, I might say something. But if I felt like okay, this guy's just being a jerk.
Yeah.
And there's no point in telling him he's being a jerk because he's just going to keep being a jerk.
Yeah.
Then I wouldn't waste my time.
No, but if it's a friend or somebody that you feel you can actually
talk to. Yeah, well, like, you know, yeah, if because that's an important part to me is three people whom you respect and value. The people I respect and value, I'm usually honest about everything. Yeah. So in that context, I'm almost definitely going to say something just because if I respect and value these people, that's how I'm going to talk to them because that's the way I want them to talk to me.
Yeah.
You know, whether that's going to offend them back or something, I don't know, but that's probably what I would do. But would this be a complex question for most people? Because I think it's a very straightforward question for us.
It doesn't make me say what the hell kind of question is that. which is the thing. When there's ones that I'm like, it's self-evident that there is only one answer. I don't feel that way in this. I think there are other functional human beings out there that would not come to the same answer we have. That being said, I would have been shocked if either of us had not come to that answer.
Well, I know I've run into a lot of people who seem to have a difficult time being friends with people their friends aren't friends with, mm-hmm. which is a problem I've never had.
Yeah. Because you have no friends.
No, if I'm around a group of friends and they say, well, so-and-so is whatever, I have no problem saying, well, this person's my friend. They've never done anything to me. I have no problem with this person. And I don't lose these friends by saying that, you know, somehow I've always been able to be friends with whoever I wanted. And if those two people weren't friends with each other, it didn't matter. But I think a lot of people do feel like it's a lapse in loyalty to be friends with this person that this other person doesn't like.
Well, and you and I both, you more on principle, you hold to concepts of tact and propriety up until the point where you feel they cause you to be dishonest.
Right, exactly.
I hold to concepts of tact and propriety only as far as I feel that they have a practical use. Hmm. So, if I'm inappropriate here, like, it's going to hurt this person's feelings or it's going to mess up this thing for my friend, then I'm doing it. But if it's like, if I'm inappropriate here, this person will feel I'm not groveling well enough or whatever. Fuck it. Fuck it. And same thing with tact. If not having tact is going to make that person cry and it's not somebody that I want to cry, I'm going to be tactful. If not having tact will just make them embarrassed about the shit that they already did themselves or whatever, or just make, you know, me to get some glares from strangers, fuck it.
Yeah.
Jesse Hyatt is my spirit animal. Like he said.
Your spirit animal. Jesse Hyatt didn't say that. You shouldn't scandalize Jesse Hyatt that way.
He's my spirit animal. I know. Jesus, that's the title right there. That's nice. Jesse Hyatt is my spirit animal.
But that's a really... I mean, that's a callback from years ago.
I know, but it's also right in the zeitgeist because I'm hitting the concept of is my spirit animal just after it's played out. Like, it's right at the time now where everybody hates it. So, it's perfect. Yeah. All right, we are over time.
Okay.
So, to all of you at home and to William here and to anyone else who might listen in the future... Get out of my house.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.